The next case is number 052902, United States against Groves. Mr. Wimhoff.
Good morning, Your Honor, and members of the Seventh Circuit. May it please the Court, at 9:40 on a summer evening on July 5, 2004, Elton Chavez was sitting on his front porch when he heard the discharge of what he thought initially was a very loud firecracker. Peering around a tree, he was moving to go inside, and he claims to have seen from a distance of 220 to 250 feet the person firing what was believed to be a shotgun. After that, he called 911, and he told the operator he did not know who the shooter was. And when asked if the shooter lives there, Chavez says, "I'm guessing." The police arrived that night and told Chavez, quote, "he's shooting a shotgun," end of quote. Chavez says that he told the police it was the guy on the porch, but he provided no identifying characteristics other than to say that the shooter was a black male and he was wearing dark or black clothes. The police spoke to Daniel Groves Sr. that night, and Daniel denied having a firearm. Daniel admitted to being a convicted felon. He admitted to setting off fireworks with his girlfriend's daughter, and he also denied consent to the police to search his apartment. So the police tried to get a warrant to search. They were unsuccessful. They waited until Daniel was at work. And when his girlfriend, Shante Foster, was at Daniel's apartment on July 21st, the police came to Daniel's apartment and asked Ms. Foster to search the premises. First words out of her mouth were that she had to get Daniel's consent, as she was there cleaning that day and had gotten the key to Daniel's apartment without him knowing. The police said that the issue of consent was between the police and Foster, and then read her the consent form, which she signed. Now, Officer Batani, who was the police officer there, said that they did not know that there was a warrant outstanding on this Shante Foster. However, he testified that as he was leaving, he made mention of this warrant to Shante Foster. The police searched the apartment and even went into a nightstand that contained Daniel's personal effects on Daniel's side of the bed. There was another nightstand next to the bed which had Shante Foster's personal effects, and it was in the nightstand that had Daniel's personal effects that ammunition was found. No firearm was ever found.
The record does show that her personal effects were in the other nightstand.
No, Your Honor. There was no evidence to show that there was any personal effects in either nightstand that belonged to both people.
Oh, I see. I thought I heard you say that her personal effects were in one of the nightstands.
Yes, sir. That is correct. They were in one nightstand on one side of the bed. His personal effects were in one nightstand on the right side of the bed.
I'm still a little confused. There was her belongings on one side and his belongings on the other side?
Yes, sir. Two nightstands, one on each side. One's hers, one's his. Your Honor, there are a number of issues which we present for Your Honors to consider. The first one deals with the identification. We believe that the second prong of Cruz is being implicated in this case. We believe that due process protection should be extended to Daniel under the facts of this case and in this situation. Cruz requires that for someone to make a proper in-court identification, that they need knowledge and an ability to reconstruct what had happened at the criminal occurrence, or at the alleged criminal occurrence. But first of all, they have to have the knowledge of what happened. They have to have that fundamental knowledge. And from the facts that were presented to the Honorable District Court in this case, there is no way that those facts could have been present. There was simply none of the Biggers facts were simply not present in a sufficient amount to allow this to go to the jury. As far as to the consent to search the apartment that belonged to Daniel, we submit to you that the court's order was an error because it failed to find the Schneckloth factors. There are a number of factors stated in Schneckloth versus Bustamante, and these factors were not contained in the order, nor was there any evidence produced in pursuant to the suppression hearing. There was also a very fatal inconsistency, what we believe is a fatal inconsistency in the testimony of the police officer, Officer Batani, when he said that, well, we didn't know if this was actually the Shante Foster who we had the warrant on, but as he's leaving, he says, we mentioned to her the existence of a warrant. Now, Daniel has said that Shante Foster was threatened and her consent was subverted by the police. This would tend to indicate that the police may have, in fact, done so, and therefore this issue was not even addressed, was not resolved by the Honorable District Court in its order. The demeanor of the witnesses is not necessarily determinative, but also too, when we take a look at whether consent was properly contained or not, even if we assume that consent was properly obtained, Shante Foster did not have consent to the entire apartment to include the individual nightstands, the one nightstand on the right side of the bed that was used by Daniel. It was very clear that she had said she had taken the key without Daniel knowing it, that she cleaned the apartment, she was cleaning it that day, that she lived at a number of different places, and yeah, she did sleep over there occasionally, but there's no indication, there's no evidence that she had any right to the nightstand on the right side of the bed, which is where Daniel kept his things, where the ammunition was kept, and where he slept.
Mr. Wemhoff, I
yes,
want
ma'am.
To ask you, and I'm going to ask the government the same question, but I want to know why you did not cite United States versus Lopez in your interstate commerce argument about the gun. It's Supreme Court precedent that strongly supports your argument, so you know that really puzzles me. I mean, is there some reason that you didn't find it relevant? Lopez, you know, of course, is the case where it's the case involving the federal ban on guns near schools, and the Supreme Court found there that there was an insufficient link to interstate commerce and struck down the law.
You know, Your Honor, it's a case, I can't really give you a good reason why I didn't cite it, to tell you the truth. I think that what we were saying is that in our rebuttal was that what we're dealing with here is potentially a situation where interstate commerce could attach to everything we do, and that the Seventh Circuit has very wisely taken a look at the situations involving Section 922 and restricted them to certain bits of evidence to prove that they moved throughout commerce, and that's why you had to actually, or that's why someone has to physically identify the weapon. Even if you don't have the weapon at the trial to present to the jury, there must be someone who identified the gun or the weapon and said, this is where it was made, this is who it was made by, and then present that evidence. That was not the case here. All we had was from 220 to 250 feet, a view of what appeared to be a shotgun or what sounded to be a shotgun by Mr. Chavez, who had done some rabbit hunting in the past. Mr. Finney testified that all major manufacturers of shotguns are outside the state of Indiana. Well, that excludes minor manufacturers. And how hard is it to make a shotgun? And if there's a minor manufacturer, that minor manufacturer may actually be in the state of Indiana. And so, therefore, there was insufficient evidence to show that this item passed through commerce or was made somehow.
Mr. Wemhoff, I assume that Mr. Groves was sentenced to concurrent terms for count 1 and 2.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. So even if we would reverse the gun possession for insufficient evidence, he would have the same sentence because of the ammunition charge. Is that true?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Your Honor, I would submit to you, too, that in the sentencing procedure that was followed here, the Honorable Court announced a tentative decision of the sentencing, and there's no room in Rule 32A14 or A4 for such a tentative decision. Obviously, the process is one that would allow for justice to be tailored individually to each person, to allow the attorney and to the defendant and the government also to address the court because they may say something that would change the court's mind. And that is, I think, the wisdom of Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 32AI4.
Well, is the government correct that the district court did, in fact, give Groves and his attorney a chance to speak?
The government is
before,
correct about that,
right.
Your Honor.
Well,
yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
But it was announced as a tentative ruling, and when a tentative, there's no room for a tentative ruling in the rule. And to say it's a tentative ruling is effectively to say this was the ruling of the court. This is how they were going to go.
Well, I'm not sure that that's quite how it happened from what I read. I mean, Judge Sharp announced preliminary rulings and then allowed the defendant and the government to speak before pronouncing sentencing. Where is the error in conducting a sentencing in that manner? I mean, it might have been a bit confusing, but where's the error?
The error, Your Honor, is that it would suggest that he has made up his mind. It would indicate that he's made up his mind. There's no such requirement. There's no such authority for him under the criminal rule 32AI4 for him to do that. And there's a reason for that. And that reason we submit to you is that to allow the parties to say what they want to say to the judge, and then he can render his opinion.
What was the recommendation of the probation department as to sentence?
Your Honor, I we had a pre-sentence report.
Right.
And they made a recommendation that the court, to a large degree, followed.
So that period of months was already tentative, at least in the sense it was submitted to the parties and the judge, right?
It was before the parties and the judge, Your Honor, but still the opportunity for that defendant, for his attorney to say something without any thought that this is what the judge was going to do, still leaves open, we believe, the credibility of the process.
Yeah, but you had the chance to say something.
Yeah.
There was an allocution.
We did.
Before final sentence was imposed.
We did have an opportunity, Your Honor, and we did make a statement, and we did offer to present testimony also. I see that my time is almost up. I believe that's the five-minute warning. I'm sorry. Is that correct?
You're into your rebuttal time.
I'm at 5 minutes. My time is up?
You are using your rebuttal time now.
Oh, okay, Your Honor. I'll reserve. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wemhoff. We'll hear now from Mr. Schmidt.
Good morning. To answer, Judge, your question, the probation department calculated a range where the sentencing range was 41 to 51 months. So that was before the court at the time of sentencing. And I can tell you, as a person that appears in the district court on scores of sentencings each year, it's a great aid to counsel to know which direction the court is headed before we stand up and argue. In this case, the government was arguing for additional time, including for an obstruction of justice enhancement, and some additional time because of the defendant's incredible criminal history, which wasn't fully reflected in his criminal history category. So Mr. Wemhoff had an opportunity to speak. The defendant had an opportunity to speak, didn't take it. The government argued, and then the court announced its final decision. And I would submit that Rule 32 does allow that kind of procedure.
Mr. Schmidt, I really want to talk about Lopez with you because I was really surprised, you know, not to see it in either brief. It seems to me that it's a very, you know, relevant Supreme Court case that eviscerates a good part of your argument about the gun, because your argument that shooting at a place where construction workers live affects interstate commerce would federalize a good amount of traditional state law and is, you know, it's quite a stretch in light of Lopez. So if you are prepared, I'd appreciate an explanation of how Lopez affects your argument if we find that there was insufficient evidence to show that the gun traveled in interstate commerce. This, you know, major minor stuff.
Your Honor, I hope I am prepared. The government's argument in this area, on this issue, is really three-pronged. And the first pronged is perhaps the most fundamental, and that is that this issue has been waived by the defendant. The defendant made a motion for judgment of acquittal below. However, that motion was only arguing that it wasn't the defendant who possessed the firearm. It was on the issue of identification. Never raised the issue that there was an alleged failure of proof on the in or affecting commerce element of the statute. And under this court's decisions in Moore and McDonough, if you make a motion for judgment of acquittal and raise specific grounds, you can't later on appeal claim other grounds on insufficiency of the evidence claims. So first and fundamentally, the defense has waived this claim, and this court ought not to even get to it.
Could it be examined under a plain error rule?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Your Honor. Secondly, the defense argues that there was no evidence presented that the firearm traveled in or was shipped in interstate commerce, and that simply isn't true. The evidence was that the firearm at issue here was a shotgun. Then the expert testimony was that there is no major manufacturers of shotguns in the state of Indiana.
That doesn't preclude it being made in Indiana, does it?
That's correct, Your Honor. There is a possibility, a theoretical possibility, that someone in his or her basement could manufacture a shotgun.
Or maybe a minor manufacturer.
What's interesting here, and I think telling, is that the defense counsel never once argued in closing or anywhere else in the trial that the government had a failure of proof on this issue.
So it seems to me it's always the government's burden to prove. I mean, that was my district days are long ago, but that was absolutely, they used to get up and explain immediately, the nexus to interstate commerce the government didn't prove this element beyond a reasonable doubt here, and the error, as you so aptly admit, could be plain and was plain.
Here, Your Honor, I think we did prove it in different ways. One is the more typical way that the firearm traveled in or was shipped in commerce. Here, there's no major manufacturers. The possibility, the unlikelihood that a shotgun was manufactured in Indiana was so remote that the defense counsel didn't even argue it in closing.
But it's your burden, and
it
if it's 0.001% that it wasn't, then it wasn't.
As the defense acknowledges in their brief, the statute doesn't require that it be traveled or shipped in interstate commerce. The statute only requires that the possession of the firearm be in or affecting commerce. And here, there's multiple ways that the evidence at trial, presented at trial, showed that. Number one was that this shotgun fired shells that were conclusively determined at the trial to have been manufactured out of state. So we had the defendant's possession of the shotgun firing shells that were manufactured out of state.
That's what really has puzzled me. Because the government had such good proof on the ammunition charge, it's very difficult to understand why the gun charge was brought with such thin evidence about the origin of the gun.
Your Honor, the situation that the investigators faced and ultimately the prosecution faced was that the defendant disposed of this firearm before we could get to it. And if the defense arguments are to be accepted, in any case where the defendant is able to dispose of the firearm, then the government would be absolutely precluded from ever proving a felon in possession of a firearm case.
Well, that's not the
Seventh Circuit's law.
No, not at all. The agent The agent didn't elicit enough testimony. All he said was, there are no major manufacturers. Well, then the next question would be, are there minor manufacturers? No, there are no minor manufacturers. Then the next question would be, how would you go about, you know, building a shotgun in your basement? You know, what would the chances of, I mean, there was there's a lot missing here.
Questioning could have been more detailed, but and the inferences are drawn obviously in the government's favor. What I draw from the major-minor distinction is there's no company out there in Indiana making shotguns. And what the expert was unwilling to say is that there are no manufacturers in Indiana that can make a shotgun because, as Mr. Wemhoff said, it's possible to make a shotgun, even on an individual basis. And so he didn't say there's no manufacturers in Indiana. And he would have been uncomfortable, and he was uncomfortable. I put him on the stand. And so he said it in this way, there are no major manufacturers. And yes, Your Honor, in retrospect, could I
have
asked...
Well, you can also make, shotgun shells, too.
But in this particular case, Your Honor, the defendant didn't dispose of the shotgun shells, both the spent ones on the ground and the ones in his apartment.
No, but the testimony
and we were able to recover those and show where they were actually manufactured. Here he did dispose of the firearm, so we were left with a different kind of proof. And we didn't cite the Lopez case because Lopez seemed more concerned with Congress's power to regulate where they didn't include an express interstate nexus element. 922G1 is different from the statute at issue in Lopez because it has an express interstate nexus element to satisfy that constitutional requirement, to tie it to Congress's commerce power. And we did cite the more recent Gonzales versus Raich case in which the Supreme Court said that even intrastate activities can have an effect on interstate commerce. And that's exactly what, again, happened here. We had a potential, to accept the defense's argument, we had a potential intrastate shotgun that had an impact, an effect on interstate commerce because intrastate shotgun possession and purchases and the like have an effect on interstate commerce in the buying and selling of shotguns, just the same as in
Gonzales. Has the Wicker argument ever been accepted in the context of this criminal statute?
No, Your Honor. To my knowledge, there isn't a case that's addressed it expressly before. And I hope this case is not the one, because I think the more fundamental problem here is waiver and the fact that the government did put on evidence, credible evidence, that the defense didn't even argue otherwise, that this shotgun both traveled in interstate commerce and affected interstate commerce.
You know, you call it waiver. It might have been very good trial strategy. In other words, if I were a defense counsel and I realized that the government hadn't proven an element, I don't know that, you know, I don't know that I would start giving the government ideas.
But this court has said the defense can't lay in wait, Your Honor. You can't argue motion for judgment of acquittal on certain grounds and then hide behind another argument by not raising it in the district court and letting it be examined first in the district court.
Let me get you off your higher wire act here. I'm a little... a little concerned about the witness identification because at the time of the 9/11 call, Mr. Chavez was asked if he knew who the shooter was, and he said no, I think. What changed between that call and the trial? How did he come to know who the shooter was? Remember, he said, I'd be guessing.
I think the transcript reveals, Your Honor, that the 9/11 call, which was in a highly charged state, because he's still firing. You actually hear a shot during the call if you listen to the actual tape. He's describing the person across the street, where he is, and the operator said, you know, does he live there? And he said, I'm guessing he lives there. He didn't say he didn't know who it was. In fact,
He didn't say, I'm guessing he lives there, did he?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that. But it was in response to a question from the 9/11 operator, does he live there? And he said, I'm guessing he does. This is a little different than what my colleague, the counsel, presented it. This was a person that Mr. Chavez was familiar with, had seen him around in front barbecuing, and so this was a face that he already knew. This was not a cold first-time identification. This was a neighbor. And he saw him across the street after the shotgun was fired, literally bent down to see him under the tree, saw him, the porch light was on, and all the evidence was at trial, both from the shotgun shells recovered there, from the eyewitness testimony as to where the shots were fired.
So in other words, the way you're viewing, I'm guessing, is I'm guessing he lives there, whereas the defense is viewing it as, if I answered, I'd be guessing. Is that fair or not?
Right. I think that's the inference I draw. Did he actually live there? And he said, yes, I think he lives there. I'm guessing he lives there.
Uh-huh.
As I listened to the tape, and if you actually listened to the tape. The problem with this identification issue is the defense, again, never objected to the introduction of the identification. That evidence came in very simply during the trial. And now they're arguing that some due process right attaches to it. The defense concedes.
When these shots were fired, were they? Did any of the shot hit the house?
No evidence that the shots actually hit. But three witnesses testified, Your Honor, that the shots were fired in the direction of Dismas' house. And that's why his sentence was enhanced for criminal recklessness for firing in the direction of a person. But in this particular case, there was no pretrial identification of any kind, no show-up, no lineup, nothing of any sort. And so you don't even get to the due process analysis because there was no unduly suggestive prior taint on the in-court identification. If this court were to adopt a due process analysis based on this factual setting, you'd have to overrule a line of cases from this court, including Alanis, Johnson, and Rodriguez, which said simple identifications in court by themselves without a prior tainted one, where you show somebody an individual, you show them a particular picture, simple identification in courts don't raise these due process concerns. And why not? Because we have juries that can observe the in-court identifications, and if there's any problems with it, they can take that into account. This is the province of the jury, reliability and credibility of witness statements and witness identifications. I hardly talked about the suppression issue. I'll make just one brief comment.
I'll give you an extra minute to do that, sir, if you will please address the sufficiency of the district court's findings. I've got a real problem with the lack of findings. And we're going to give you a few extra minutes, sir, in terms of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. There were two fundamental issues raised in the suppression motion. One was, did Shanta Foster, the defendant's live-in girlfriend, not simply a maid, but live-in girlfriend, have sufficient authority to consent to the search of the apartment, which she did. She consented to the search of the entire apartment. And secondly, was she coerced? Okay. Was she coerced in that consent? And on the first point, the evidence is, and the district court's findings were as follows. She was the defendant's live-in girlfriend. She shared common authority over the apartment. She received bills at the apartment in her name. She paid for the telephone. Her daughter, a first grader, was registered from school from the apartment. She had her belongings, her clothing, her perfumes there in the apartment, in the bedroom. Mr. Groves and Ms. Foster shared the very bedroom in which the ammunition was recovered. And there were two nightstands. One was a nightstand with her belongings, as Mr. Wemhoff said. The other was a nightstand with his belongings, and the ammunition was in there. But she had authority to go anywhere in the apartment, including to clean, so much so that she acknowledged at the suppression hearing that she had previously thrown out ammunition that she had discovered in the apartment. She lived there. And if you And the district court's advantage was to be there and to listen to her testify and unfortunately lie. Although he was polite in his order, she lied.
I think we have the point. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Could I just ask one quick? Does the record tell us if the first grader was his daughter?
No, Your Honor, it was her daughter only.
I know it was hers.
Not hers.
Not
his.
Their daughter.
That's correct.
Okay.
And on the issue of the sufficiency of the order, he then addresses in the credibility determinations that it was Task Force Agent Batani who he believed on the issue of coercion, and as a result of that, accepted his version of the events, which was there was no coercion, no threats to arrest her, no threats to take the child away from her, nothing like that, and he discredited Ms. Foster's testimony that she was somehow coerced. Thank you.
How much time did Mr. Wemhoff have?
He has 3 minutes.
3 minutes, okay. You now have six. You have 6 minutes, sir.
Thank you.
Members of the court, please allow me to address some of the items that were brought up by my very esteemed colleague, Mr. Schmidt. First of all, when it comes to issues concerning what this firearm fired or what this shotgun fired, we don't know. There were no tests done on the spent cartridges that were found. That's in the record. No tests were done on the spent cartridges, so we don't know what fired them. We don't know how old they were. We don't know, because we never had this weapon, this shotgun, brought into court or identified by anyone, we don't know what it fired. We have no idea. So there is a real question there as to whether this weapon even fired any of the ammunition that was supposedly involved here. We don't know what happened to the firearm. And so, therefore, we submit to the court that because we don't know anything about this firearm, we can't say it passed through interstate commerce. So, and we can't say that it fired the shells that were ultimately presented at court that were produced in another state. We can't say that. Nobody can make that conclusion because we don't have the weapon that was supposedly fired that night. And there were no tests done on the ammunition, the spent cartridges that were found.
Well, what about Mr. Schmidt's argument that every criminal who throws away their weapon, where do we go?
Well, Your Honor, there's no... I can understand the concern of the government that there may be a concern that criminals may do that, but we have to deal with facts, and we have to deal with the facts that are presented here. And there's no evidence that Daniel did that, that it was thrown away. What we have is a situation in this case where we have an individual trying to identify Daniel from a distance of 220 to 250 feet, trying to see and listen to what was being fired on a summer, looking through foliage across a street and down a road. And if you take a look at the length of this courtroom, it's probably about 85 feet, I would say, from that wall to that wall. And so you're looking at approximately 2.5 times and looking through foliage in a split second. What was said to the 911 operator, I believe, was you all have read it, and I believe, Your Honor, you quoted it, actually. So then the opportunity for Mr. Chavez to do any sort of proper identification was just simply not there. He just didn't have the baseline to do it. Your Honor, you mentioned something about the sentencing that I'd like to address. The pre-sentence report, you're right, is out there. It has recommendations in it. But we submit to you, sir, that those recommendations are a lot different from a court showing which way he would rule, and I wanted to address that. Your Honor, I think that you're troubled, as we are, with the interstate nexus, and that's why I bring up the issue about the ammunition and what kind of weapon was this that was supposedly fired. I think there's also another troubling issue, too, about how much do we get involved into interstate commerce, and what the Seventh Circuit has so wisely done in the past is to really be very limited on how it's construed that statute. But we would submit to you that within those limits set by this honorable court that you know, this case just doesn't fall within those limits, and therefore there should be no conviction.
But will it change anything?
I'm sorry?
Will it change anything? I mean, if we reverse on the gun conviction, what does it change? You know, we've got him being sentenced on counts 1 and 2. And the ammunition charge looks pretty good, doesn't it?
It serves justice, Your Honor.
Say it again.
It serves justice. And if there are issues with the suppression, which the court has been briefed on and have asked questions about, then there's a very real possibility that Daniel's sentence may be entirely thrown out.
Well, sure. I mean, if this court suppresses the search, but if the court doesn't suppress the search, then you've got concurrent terms for count 1 and 2, and even if we would reverse the gun possession, he would have the same sentence because of the ammunition charge.
It would serve justice, Your Honor.
No. That part I understand very well. But just practically speaking.
I understand
your
point.
Yeah.
I may say something about the suppression motion since we seem to be going that way. The police officer, Officer Batani, stated in his testimony that Shante Foster said, I don't have authority to give you permission to search the premises. And I believe it is also in the record that the officer believed her. Despite that, he went on and he proceeded to ask her questions. There's a very strong instance here of her subjective belief that she did not have the authority to consent, especially since she had said that she had taken the key. She didn't have access to the key and she was cleaning that day. And so, what is it about a form that can suddenly change her consent? We ask that the court find that the suppression motion was improperly denied, and we also ask for other relief as asked in our appellate brief. I'm open to any other questions you may have in my remaining time.
I gather not. Thank you, sir. Mr. Wim Hof, you also served by appointment of this court, and you have the court's deep thanks for your fine efforts on behalf of your counsel, of your client. Indeed, our thanks to both attorneys in the case, and we will take the case under advisement.